You know, we're pretty lucky here in Wisconsin to have so many fascinating birds that will hang with us the whole year around. But there's a whole lot more who spend their summers here, and then they go elsewhere where it's warmer. This is the time of the year for that migration to be going. Larry Mueller here. Again, thanks for joining us today on this holiday. Happy Labor Day to you. And we certainly love to have a chance to talk about birds whenever we have a holiday, as a matter of fact. And Bill Volkert's been doing this with us for many a year. He's been watching and studying birds for probably 40 years. Spent 27 years as a naturalist at Horican Marsh. And Bill, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us again.
Always my pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
Oh, and Tom Schultz, great to have Tom back. A very well-known wildlife artist. He's the former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, served for several years as a member of the steering committee for the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project. And Tom, thank you for coming back.
My pleasure also, Larry.
You know, this is always a lot of fun. If you have questions, maybe you've seen some birds, wondering what you've seen, perhaps, or questions about migration, wondering about where birds are and where they've gone to, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Always love to see photos. If you get some bird photos and or bird questions, go to our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show, and I see we already have a couple of Facebook comments up, and there's room for more. So go to our Facebook page, or, hey, if you want to email us, go to talk@wpr.org, and you can email us as well. And that fall migration, in the beginning, I said there are some birds on the move, and in fact, there are, aren't there, Bill?
Oh, absolutely. We refer to it as fall migration, and for the vast variety of birds that we have, they each have their own time of year. And I always find that migration, whether it's the spring arrival or fall departure birds, it's a way to gauge that changing of the seasons. So actually, we see the first sandpipers that are coming back from the tundra breeding grounds oftentimes in July.
Already coming back in July.
But these are either the failed breeders, males that head up there, look for a mate, are not successful, or oftentimes those that leave the female to raise the young, and then they depart, perhaps to take some of the pressure off the breeding grounds and leave the food there. So these are such capable flyers. To head to the tundra, turn around, and come back 1,000 miles is not a big deal. And we'll see them showing up in Wisconsin then in July, and especially August is a big month of movement. The seasons get short quickly up there in the tundra.
Yeah.
And then there's also that silent migration, which is the songbirds that are moving through the forest in August and now continuing through September. The leaves are still so thick on the trees, they're not singing for the most part this time of year. And it's this sort of silent procession overhead as the birds are moving through. Unless you take a little time to really peer up in there and look for them, they just seem to pass overhead. And I think it's oftentimes in retrospect you realize that, oh, gee, I haven't seen
suddenly
them in a long
gone.
Time. They must have left.
Well, you know, this is kind of cool, Tom. We have a Facebook comment from Robert already who says nighthawks have been silently moving through Eau Claire since the 15th of August. He says swallows are gone. We've got fall warblers coming through right now. Sounds like about right, isn't it?
It's pretty normal migration period this year. The nighthawks like to move. They're eaters of flying insects, aerial insects, and so they migrate through when it's still warm, working their way southward.
What's the longest distance that a bird will migrate through Wisconsin?
In any one shot, are you talking about?
Yeah, I'm just, you know, what's the furthest they will go back and forth?
Well, the fact is we're actually just beginning to see some of the extraordinary migration abilities of birds because of new technology. So by putting the transmitters or the little geotags on the birds, we're able to track their daily movements. And it was about 5-6 years ago, it just astounded the world when we were looking at the bar-tailed godwit, which is a bird that nests where Alaska and Siberia meet, right on both sides there. They winter off the coast of Australia and New Zealand, and the population worldwide has declined by about 50%. So there's a lot of concern among the biologists and conservationists. What's the problem? What's going on? And one of the questions is the problem perhaps more on the migratory stopover grounds? So along the China and Korean coast, are wetlands disappearing and have an effect? So they put the transmitters on the birds. What they found was that these birds actually were making nonstop flights, leaving Alaska. We had one bird that flew for 9 days, 9 nights straight, nonstop, covered 7,800 miles in one shot.
Never stopped to rest.
Never stopped. They don't swim, so if they go down the ocean, it's not like a duck. They've got to keep going, and there's no place to stop. A few of them will sometimes stop over in Hawaii or a few of the islands. It seems that the majority of them go straight on through, and we don't even know how they do that physiologically.
I mean, just almost unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, and there are things that we're now still learning about birds that are just absolutely astounding, and I don't think anybody would have even guessed that they have that ability.
Oh. Tom in Cedarburg has something for us. Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, it seems like it's at least a month ahead of normal. I live near woods and fields, and there's a pond about a half mile away, and I can hear a few cranes, and I see a few ducks and a few geese at work, but the only type of songbirds that I see left, other than the ones that stay through the winter, is I heard a towhee last weekend, and then there seems to be some whippoorwills around yet, the ones that call, you know, more in the morning and,
yeah,
and in the evening. But other than that, it seems like we're in late fall, and I'm wondering, you know, do you think this means we're going to have a bad winter
Or what? Well, maybe ask Tom, what do you think first?
I think that there's a lot of local variation on timing, just basically due to factors like rainfall, ponds that are ephemeral and may or may not be there. If you have a drought period in a particular area, birds may move on because the insects are no longer there. So there is definitely a lot of variation.
Yeah. Bill?
Well, I think there's also a bit of a difference between what I refer to as the flocking of birds and the actual migration. So in other words, in summer, they're nesting, rearing their young. At this time, late summer, all the young are growing up. Even for birds that have had multiple broods, such as robins, the last family should be out. A few late nesters may still be on the nest, goldfinches, cedar waxwings, a couple of those mourning doves may yet still be trying to raise one more family. But what happens then is once that family's mobile, they're all grown up and capable of flying, it is yet, for many birds, several weeks, if not even a few months before they actually have to depart. So what we're seeing are local movements of birds. They may then leave one area and go to where there's more food available, as Tom said, particularly water-dependent birds. One thing I've noticed is the Canada geese are really gathering up in flocks. They're honking and flying around. They're much more visible than they've been most of the summer. These are not the migrants. We know from our observations at Horicon that the migrants coming down from central Canada arrive every year, somewhere between about the 15th and 21st of September. That's when the first ones come. And, of course, during October is when we start to really peak as more and more of them come down and join the flock. What we're really seeing are the local nesting geese that are all capable of flying, and now these single families are starting to form together in larger flocks, moving around where there's available food, and are just beginning to form flocks. Those birds, they may not even leave Wisconsin until December, and for some of them, they may even remain as long as there's not that much snow cover that they can access food.
Yeah, and food's probably the whole thing. We have a Facebook question from Marlene who wondered why some migrate early, and probably a question of the availability of their food, I suppose.
It's all about food. The common assumption is, well, the birds have to go south because it's getting cold out. And as I've said for a long time about this phenomenon, birds are well insulated. They've got feathers. It's a great insulator. So it's not the cold weather itself, but it's the shortage of food. And what you're really finding, as Tom mentioned, with nighthawks, they're dependent on flying insects. They have to leave before we get that first severe frost because all of a sudden one night the entire food supply is gone and now you're out of luck.
Yeah.
Same with the swallows. We saw them in August really starting to flock up. They're either now in huge flocks still remaining or departing very quickly because I think any gardener knows we get into September, there's a good chance for the first frost. Now you're out of luck. Other birds will stay longer, such as our ducks, geese, and cranes, because it doesn't matter about the insect food. They access food either in uplands, such as the geese and cranes, or the ducks in the water. So where does the food shortage come? When the snow and the ice form. And so they can remain much later again. But all these insect eaters, our summer birds, they have to be on the move because it's going to get cold here. And as I say, it's not the cold weather, but it's what it does to the food supply.
And the spring migration is sort of the reverse, isn't it, Tom? Kind of looking for food along the way. And
yeah, some of it is dictated by sort of the diurnal periods, you know, as far as day length and so forth. Some of these birds are migrating up from the tropics, and they don't know what the weather's like in Wisconsin. They don't know what the mosquito or insect hatch is. So they come in here based on timing, and they trust that things will be there for them to eat. But these are nighttime migrants, and they may migrate hundreds of miles over a given night. And it's a very different migration in the spring from the fall.
Quite a bit different then. So then it's going by, is it light then, the amount of light, or is it?
Yeah, so the increasing day length is the trigger.
Okay.
In the same way that now, you know, our longest day was way back in June. It's the shortening of the day. That's really the trigger, but it is, in a sense, to anticipate either the availability or the disappearance of that food.
And again, I want to go back to Tom and say thanks, Tom, from Cedarburg, for that question. Patricia in Madison, let's go to you next.
Hi, Patricia. Hello, Larry.
Hi, thanks for calling.
I'm wondering how long the hummingbirds will be staying in the Madison area. I didn't get any in the springtime, though I did have my feeder out in May, and I've had two hummingbirds now fighting over the feeder since maybe about a month ago.
All right. The hummingbirds, how long will they be around?
I think their numbers start thinning out through the month of September, and probably when you start getting the harder freezes, most of them are gone. By the time the flowering plants have stopped blooming, the nectar supply is gone. If you have a hummingbird feeder, you may maintain birds longer. And that's actually the time of year when serious bird watchers like to actually keep their hummingbird feeders going, because that's when the vagrants start showing up, the more unexpected, out-of-range species.
And to give them a helping hand and a chance to see them.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
And by the way, I know there's a myth that has been out there for a long time. It comes up most often at this time of the year. Is there a problem of keeping your hummingbird feeders up, and will that keep the birds from migrating? And the fact is no. What's really driving, as we said, was the shortening of the day length. This is instinctive. Now is when they may need that food to refuel. And so, no, don't have any fear of keeping it up there and keeping birds from migrating. They're going to go when they know it's time.
All right. Thanks, Patricia. Appreciate it. Jeff in Madison, your turn next. Hi, Jeff. Jeff, are you there? Oh, maybe we lost Jeff. He had a question about a peregrine falcon. So we'll come back to him. Just to let you know, we're talking bird migration today with Bill Volkert, naturalist, retired wildlife educator from Horican Marsh and the International Education Center with the Department of Natural Resources. Tom Schultz, well-known wildlife artist, former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Our guests, you can join in, by the way, the open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And if you've got some good bird photos, we'd love to see them as well. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, though, we're taking a look at birds and bird migrations with our two guests, Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz. Love to have them along, and certainly great to have you listening in. And again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You got a great photo up right now from Daniel Vassar, a photo of, what do we got there? What's that bird?
Ruby-throated hummingbird.
Yeah, ruby-throated hummingbird, which is the only real common hummingbird in all of the eastern U.S. But as Tom mentioned earlier, keep your feeders up, because every so often we'll have some of the strays or stragglers from out west, such as Anna's hummingbird, Rufus hummingbird. They may show up, so watch for the oddball that may be coming through. And it seems that some of these are actually increasing in the numbers or frequency that birders are finding them at the feeders at this time of year. So maybe there's a little bit of a shift in the migration of these birds as well to the east.
Daniel got a really nice photo.
Absolutely.
A really, really nice photo. Thanks for sending that in. And I think we're, we still may have, Jeff, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me, guys?
Yeah, now we can hear you. Thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm calling you from the beautiful Wyalusing area. And yesterday we were kayaking down on the Wisconsin River about 1 mile from the Mississippi River, and I'm pretty sure that I saw a peregrine falcon. And but it was doing an unusual thing in an unusual place, and so my main question is, could I possibly have seen a peregrine at that place at this time of year?
I don't know why not, Bill.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the peregrine falcons will actually follow the migration of the shorebirds and even the waterfowl. The old name for it was the duck hawk. I've actually seen them chasing more sandpipers than I have ducks. Probably for a sort of mid-size or somewhat larger falcon. Duck gets to be a pretty heavy prey item for them, but sandpipers are pretty easy for them to snatch. And they're moving through right now. We've got local breeding birds in some of the different areas in Wisconsin where we set up some of the nests for them on the power plant smokestacks right here in Madison, some of the tall buildings, and there's even some nesting along the Mississippi River. And we also have birds that are moving out from the Arctic regions, and they'll be migrating through. So a real mix, and yeah, they can show up almost anywhere at any time as we get into this time of year. They're definitely on the move.
Yeah, that's interesting because we were kayaking along and I saw this bird sitting on a sandbar, so just on the ground, on the sand, and I immediately knew it was not like any shorebird. And as we got closer, I thought, could that possibly be? And then I thought, no, that must be a Cooper's hawk. And we got close enough to see, I saw the head markings of a peregrine.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
And then when it flew, it definitely had peregrine wings. And it was eating something right on the ground, on the sand. So maybe that was something like a sandpiper.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask, is if it was actually eating on something. It's an unusual place for it to sit. They usually would perch up higher. But if he came down to snatch something, very likely that he was having lunch.
Having a little lunch. Thanks a lot for calling. I was just reminded of the other day when my daughter Emily and her niece Kiera were playing softball with Emily's softball team, and there was a red tail on the ground out just on the other side of the fence. You could see them, and of course they went running over to take a look, and he was guarding a snake that he had captured.
That's an interesting food choice.
Yeah, so he had a little garter snake, so it was kind of fun to see, and the girls got a big kick out of it, that's for sure. We have, thanks again, Jeff, Adam in Sturgeon Bay. It's your turn. Hi, Adam.
Hey, how are you? Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Thanks for calling.
Hey, yesterday, I still am on Washington Island, and yesterday my wife and I were just walking on the shoreline, and I saw what was, I believe, was like a family of whooping cranes. They're very stark white and giant. Pretty amazing. I was just wondering, is that common or
whoopers?
You know, pardon me.
I was just looking at Tom and saying whoopers. What about it?
I would say that would be pretty unusual for Washington Island. There's certainly a population of whooping cranes that's become established in the central part of the state.
Yeah, and, well, that's why I called, because I wanted to let somebody know, and I'm really glad for the show this morning. And I don't know what else they could have been. Cause
did you see them on the ground or flying?
Pardon me?
Were they on the ground or were they flying?
They're both.
Okay. The reason I ask is because whooping crane, if they're standing, I mean, that's a very tall, slender bird.
It was like six
it's hard
tall.
To mistake. Okay. Yeah, if it's in flight, you might see all white bird with the black on the wings, and more common up in your area might be pelicans.
That's no, okay. it was not a pelican.
So you might have an unusual sighting.
Yeah, that would be.
That's one of the reasons why I called, because I thought it was really uncommon. and I wanted someone to know if you guys.
You know, you should go online to eBird. Would that be a good place to go?
Yeah, my wife and I looked on the internet and crane with the crane identification and all that, and we were like, there can't be anything else.
Did you happen to notice whether there were color bands on the legs of those birds? Because all of the whooping cranes in Wisconsin have color bands attached to them, and you can tell by the arrangement of the colors.
There was three of them sitting in the waiting in the marsh area, and then two of them came calling with a very distinct crane call, and they flew over the top of two of them flew over the top of the three that were waiting in the water, and they all took off.
Yeah.
Well, you might consider reporting that sighting. If you go online to the Whooping Crane Eastern Partnership, which is WESEP, there's a reporting form you can fill out. And if there have been other sightings up in that general area, maybe they can piece it together and determine if maybe that wasn't as unusual as we think it is.
Okay.
Yeah, it'd be pretty cool to do. Yeah, please go ahead and do that, Adam. And I'm actually... There's a reintroduction of a migratory flock of whooping cranes in the, the reintroduction has been going on, but it's been pretty successful so far?
Well, there were problems that they ran into at the Nisida area, just something that was completely unanticipated, and that's the fact that about the time that those cranes are initiating their nesting is also the time when a big black fly hatch occurs.
Oh.
And it seems to just annoy them so much that they've abandoned their nests over the last several years. And I was talking with one of the biologists out there. He said it's really unusual because if you go about 10, 15 miles from that core area, they haven't got that black fly problem. Mm-hmm. So it's very localized. And what happened, of course, the whooping crane is in the wild, exists really in just one wild flock. They're coming from west central Canada and going down to the coast of Texas. And the fear was if we had anything occur to that flock, we basically got the entire world population, you know, all your eggs in one basket. They're all vulnerable. Disease outbreak, oil spill, any other catastrophe. So they wanted to establish a second flock, and Wisconsin was chosen for that, and to train them with a different migratory flock so they didn't just somehow drift over and join the others. We trained them behind the ultralights to go instead of the Texas coast down toward Florida. Well, with the problems and some of the lack of nesting success in the Nisida flock, they started a second flock, and that's out at White River. And Tom has actually been very active with that flock for, since its inception. It's about the last 5 years.
And how's that going, Tom?
Going very well. There's an organization called Operation Migration that does the training with ultralight aircraft. And I've been a volunteer with them now for 5 years at the White River Marsh, actually not very far from where I live in Green Lake County. And it's been very successful. They raise a group of young whooping cranes at a pen and do a daily morning training to teach them to follow the ultralight. And then come late September or perhaps early October, those birds actually move southward following the ultralight on migration stops to be led to Florida, coastal Florida at St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge. And then those birds are there for the winter, and then they migrate northward again on their own.
So that's been successful, which is great. And how many birds are involved in that now?
There are six of them in that group this year, the young group.
And
they're doing extremely well this year. I would say they're pretty much ready to migrate. So when they get their ducks in a row and everything's set to start the migration, they're ready to go.
And those birds, of course, are long-lived, and it takes a number of years before they're sexually mature. So a lot of these birds won't even breed until they're, in the wild, 4, 5, even 6 years old sometimes. So we have to have a number of these releases and have a couple of enough survivors out of that and see if they'll eventually pair up on their own and start nesting. That's the hope. And I guess the real kind of ambition would be for Operation Migration to put itself out of business. In other words, it's so successfully established, the birds are doing it on their own, that we can stop intervening. But right now, they're still critically endangered as a species, and only found in North America. So it's at least been working. We've been able to bolster the population, and it is increasing. And Wisconsin's been very significant in this whole role here.
We have, back to Facebook for just a minute. Ken sent us a photo of some turkeys, wild turkeys, and there's this light-colored young turkey often visits our backyard, he says, along with 8 siblings and 2 adults. Is this coloration common? And it is quite a bit lighter.
I would say it's unusual for a wild turkey. They're primarily pretty dark in coloration, but there's an abnormality that occurs within flocks of birds sometimes, where you get one individual that has lighter colored pigmentation. It's usually called leucistic. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's variable success in the survival of that bird. It may not be as camouflaged as the other ones, so it might get picked off
a lot quicker, a lot faster. Yeah, I can see. It's kind of a cool picture. There's lots of turkeys right there in that yard. A couple, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. Anyway, there's a nice flock.
And that one certainly does stand out. And the wing feathers are very white. Leucistic is also referred to as partial albinism.
Yeah.
So it's somewhat of a lack of pigments. And it just comes up genetically in almost any of the birds.
And I know in deer it's called a piebald, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
That color.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Dana in Appleton, your turn. Thanks, Dana, for calling.
Hi, I've been lucky enough to recently move from California to Wisconsin, and I'm loving all the birds. You've already answered all my questions about the yellow finches and the geese and all the migratory birds. But this weekend, I'm up in Duluth right now heading back down, and I had the opportunity to be up on the far north lakes doing wild ricing with my son, and we saw 2 swans on this lake, and I was wondering, do they also migrate, or do they stay around for the winter?
No, they'll migrate. Swans are feeding on aquatic vegetation, so once that ice starts to form, they're basically cut off from their food supply. The swans that you saw were probably the trumpeter swans, another bird that Wisconsin's played a big role in reintroducing a breeding population, especially in the northern lakes, northwest and north central Wisconsin. And over the years, it's been more than 20 years we've been working on that project, they've done so well, they're spreading out on their own. The last couple of years, there's been more than one nesting pair at Horicon Marsh. They're showing up in other places in the state. So we really have 3 species of swans in Wisconsin. The trumpeter swan, which is then, as I say, reintroduced as a local nesting bird. As we get into late November and early December, we'll start seeing big flocks of swans coming through. These are the tundra swans, in the past called the whistling swan. They're coming down from the Arctic around Hudson Bay and some all the way up from Alaska heading to the East Coast. So an odd migration. It's not just straight north-south. It cross-cuts the entire continent. And then the other swan we may see is mute swan, which is the introduced European bird, known for that orangish-red knob on the bill.
Mm-hmm. Well, these were really trumpeting when they flew over us.
That's
the biggest of all of the swans. That is a big, big bird.
Yeah, it really is. Thanks, Dana.
You bet.
I appreciate the call. Again, you can join us, have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Another beautiful photo also up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. That's where to go. If you've got a photo you want to post of a bird, we'd love to have you post it. And Alan sent us a cedar waxwing, photo of a cedar waxwing. Isn't that a beautiful photo? He said this was along the Milwaukee River north of Mequon Road. There were more, and they were catching insects, flying insects. Pretty cool, isn't it?
That's a beautiful picture. It's a gorgeous bird. The waxwings have extremely sleek plumage.
Yeah.
So it almost looks like it's not feathers. It's almost silky looking.
Yeah. It's really, really beautiful. Thanks for sending it, Alan. Appreciate it very much. And Steven, Sun Prairie, hi.
Hey, good morning. I have a couple questions for you, both very short. One is, I had a pair of robins that built a nest on top of a gargoyle that's mounted on my garage wall between the doors, and the robins got very upset every time I walked out of the garage. And there were two of them, apparently the male and the female. And it appeared as though the male was participating in feeding the baby birds. And I'd never seen that before. I wondered, is that common? My second question is it okay to clean out bird houses at this time?
All right, so we've got robins, a couple of robins. Is it common for the male to also feed the young?
It depends on the bird species to some extent, but robins are one that have both the male and female participate in feeding the young birds at the nest. And there are some other species.
Probably most of the songbirds. You've got both parents involved. Birds like ducks, obviously. The male's just there for the mating and then takes off. The female raises them entirely. Yeah, they all have their own strategy, but yeah, not unusual for quite a few of the songbirds to do so.
And what about now for another good question from Steve was the whole business of cleaning out birdhouses. Is this a good time to clean out your birdhouse?
I would say for most birds, the breeding period is over. There are a few birds that are just finishing up nesting, perhaps at this point. But most of the birds that are breeding in boxes are probably done. There might be a late bluebird brood yet. But yes, definitely clean out the boxes. The parasites that feed on birds can often build up their numbers. There's certain types of mites and so forth that can live inside of bird boxes and bird nests. And so it's a good idea to clean them out. And the birds, when they come back, will construct a new nest again.
Do you, I don't know, put any antiseptic materials in there to kind of clean it out after you've taken the nest out? Or just is it good enough just to clean it out, maybe run some water on it?
It's probably a good idea to wash it out, just like with your bird feeders.
Yeah.
Perhaps sterilize it a little bit with a mild bleach solution.
Yeah. Okay, and Steve, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. And here's another Steve, this one from Fond du Lac. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'd like to say hi to Bill. And I have a question. My wife and I walk around a runoff pond, quite large one, in the south side of Fond du Lac. And this spring, we saw snowy egret there feeding along the edge, which was kind of fun to watch, and that with all the ducks that are there. But then later on in the spring towards summer, we found out there was two snowy egrets and a small brown bird with them. And we just saw the brown bird maybe twice, and then we didn't see it. So my assumption was one tree by the pond had the nesting pair, and we kept seeing one or the other, and then the young finally hatched. Would that be possible?
Well, what do you guys think? Bill, what do you think?
First of all, hi, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing real good.
Great. Nice to hear from you. Snowy egrets, Wisconsin's a little bit far north for the bird, especially for its nesting range. We have had some nest attempt, I think, in the Green Bay area. Very unusual. It's more of a southerly bird. What we tend to see are the individuals, the stragglers after the breeding season down south, or maybe a non-breeder that drifts up into Wisconsin. Most of those sightings tend to be in the area, say, from around Horicon Marsh, Lake Winnebago, up to Green Bay, and then over along the Mississippi occasionally. Great egret is, of course, the common egret that we find in Wisconsin as a nesting bird, but those are colonial nesters, so you'll never see just a single nest, but a large group of them, and they're kind of punctuated then of where we find them. One large group here and then nothing anywhere else. We get to midsummer, the nesting season's done for egrets, then they really disperse. So they may show up anywhere. So snowy egret, a sighting of a single one or even a pair, not unusual or completely uncommon for Wisconsin, but a nest record, that's something that would be extremely rare for Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the young would not be a brown color.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What could the white birds have been?
Well, they could have been snowy egrets that were lingering around, but the brown one, whether that was really the young necessarily. Otherwise, I'd have to kind of roll this around in my brain of what else the possibilities might be.
Ponder that for
a while.
There
are only a few mid-sized white birds, really, that occur in Wisconsin. So there aren't that many possibilities.
There aren't that many.
There are a couple of distinctions to look for. The snowy egret has a black bill, mm-hmm. whereas the great egret has a yellower colored bill. And also the snowy egret has yellow feet on mm-hmm. black legs. So if you get to see the feet, you know, in a contrasting bright yellow shade on the feet, mm-hmm. that would be snowy.
That's the giveaway.
That's the giveaway. Thanks a lot for calling. And speaking of yellow, Eric sent us a photo and says, I had this yellow-billed cuckoo in our Racine yard this morning. So it's a photo from this morning. Fed on insects for a bit and rested on a tree before heading southwest. Also this morning, we had our first Lincolns and white-throated sparrows for the fall. So they are, and that's from Racine. So, and a pretty nice photo there of that yellow-billed
cuckoo. Very nice, and interesting white-throated sparrows already showing up in Racine area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very, very cool. Thank you for sending that photo. It's a great one. By the way, go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. The photo of the yellow-billed cuckoo is in sort of in the center of our page, but most of the photos are on what is called posts to the page over on the left side of the Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. So there's where you go. Joe in Campbellsport up next. Joe, hi. Thank you for calling.
I farm near Campbellsport, and we had an unidentifiable duck-like bird here. It parked itself in the middle of the farm driveway. It was brown. It had webbed orange feet. But its beak was not duck-like. It was very sharp, and it looked like it would attack you if it got a chance. It had a really cranky-looking, crooked beak. And this bird looked and acted cranky, like he was lost and he just needed a rest. And we left him alone, and he or she flew away after a while. But it was all brown. And we've looked through many bird books, and we can't find anything that looks like that.
You mentioned webbed feet. Did you actually see the webbing, or was it just really long toes?
Actual webbed feet.
Oh, I was afraid you were going to say that. I was thinking, well, if it just had long toes, maybe a rail, which, you know, they can get off course and drop in anywhere this time of year if they get a little disoriented. Webbed feet. You know, the other possibility is that if there's something that is not in your field guide and you just can't find in any book of birds in North America, there are people who keep birds as breeders. And so every once in a while, there are exotics out there that'll show up. And that's oftentimes a possibility. Somebody has a game farm breeder or happens to have a license to keep exotic birds. And, you know, normally they keep them penned up or keep the wing feathers clipped, but bird can get out. I remember years ago, Tom and I pondering over something out there. We could not find a book. We wrote down descriptions and all kinds of things. It was an Egyptian goose. And then we came to realize, well, he did not fly all the way from North Africa on his own. So that would be the only other possibility. And for waterfowl, yeah, there's a huge variety of waterfowl in the world. And it may be something that is completely exotic and escaped. So that's one other possibility. Otherwise, your description for a native bird, I nothing matches up that I can think of.
I can't think of any either.
No.
There we go.
You said it was somewhat tame?
Very tame.
Oh, yeah, that may be the hint right there that he's habituated to people. And, it may be an escapee.
It was cranky but tame.
Okay.
Cranky but tame. There we go. Thanks a lot, Joe, for calling.
Well, maybe it was just feeding time and nobody was there to help him out.
Appreciate the call. Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz, birding experts extraordinaire, our guests here today on this Labor Day show. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at birds and migration with our two guests, Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz. Wonderful to have them with us. Bill's retired from the Department of Natural Resources. Tom, a wildlife artist, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. And again, join in. Questions, comments, or maybe a photo or a video to share. I hope you'll join in. If photos and videos, send them to our Facebook page. That's the title of that is The Larry Mueller Show. And we've got a really cool one from Thomas from Fitchburg in Dane County, a video he shot of, what do we got there? Some hummingbirds, haven't we, on a nest.
Ruby-throated hummingbirds, yeah. They can nest any time through the summer, and I've seen a few photographs of late nesting birds this year. Might be a second brood, hard to say for sure, but...
And this one, as you say, it's the one bird is putting its bill almost right down the throat of the other one.
Yeah, the parents regurgitate food that they've been feeding on and feed it in a sort of a semi-liquid form to the young birds. And yeah, it's almost like a sword swallowing act for those young hummingbirds.
Well, it's pretty cool to have a video of that. If you're near your Facebook page, go to the Larry Mueller Show and take a look at those photos. Take a look at that video. And speaking of, I mentioned photos because Vicki sent us some photos. She said, I sat on the beach for hours at Lake Brittany in Muskego and took some photos of sandhill cranes. Then I can colorize them on the computer. And boy, talk about some beautiful shots.
Yeah. Very nice. Very artistic.
Aren't those gorgeous?
Yes.
Very artistic. Thank you very much for sending those, Vicki. I really appreciate it. Go online. Take a look at those. They're really pretty cool. We have, in fact, I think I'm gonna kind of blow the one up on my page here. See if I can get it to go bigger. Well, I can't get it to go any bigger. But it is very, very nice. Let's go to Sylvia in Madison next. Sylvia, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I just saw a hummingbird in my bird feeder just a minute or so ago.
Good for you.
But the reason I was calling is I have a suet feeder in the back.
Yep.
And we have a couple of woodpeckers that come around. But I think I saw a yellow-bellied sapsucker, I think. Do they look like woodpeckers? Well, I mean, these are black and white woodpeckers, usually.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they always have the red head. A couple of them didn't seem to have the red head. And this is Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Is that part of their range?
Well, actually, yellow-bellied sapsucker is a woodpecker.
It's, oh, it is?
Yes, it's in the woodpecker family. The black and white ones you refer to, there is a smaller and somewhat larger one, the downy and hairy woodpecker. And you mentioned about the red on the back of the head. Only the males have that of both of those.
Okay, and is a wood sapsucker bigger or smaller?
Sapsucker is about the size of the hairy woodpecker. It does not have the white down the back, so you're going to see a dark back, but it has white panels in the wing, and then a little speckling in the breast. They're losing some of that. Well, you could also have immatures at this time of year, so they may not have that full coloration. But yeah, your best thing to look for is look in the back and the wings, where your downy and hairy woodpecker are very much a striking black and white, with the white down the back. You're going to see a very dark back, but then sort of a white panel in the wing. That's probably the best field mark. And they're migrating right now. They're moving south. The first ones are starting to move. So, yeah, not unusual to have one pop up somewhere and slowly making their way out of the north woods and are also in western Wisconsin.
So they don't really have any yellow on them?
There is a wash of yellow on the belly.
Oh.
Of course, for woodpeckers, they tend to cling to the trees. So yeah. Just like
you don't see that,
yeah, just like the red-bellied woodpecker, probably the worst name for it because it's the one field mark you don't see. actually, I think that these birds were probably named very early on in our history in North America, before optics were around. It was the old collection method, and it was the shoot and stuff the birds and have these as collections, and they're commonly as museum skins laid on their back. So I think those field marks are pretty visible in the hand like that, but not out in the field.
Okay,
there we go.
Maybe it was then, because it was a little different. I didn't quite know what it was, but it looked like a woodpecker.
Yes.
Yep. Yep. And it probably was. Probably was.
Take a good close look at the family of woodpeckers in your field guide and look at the differences between downy, hairy, and sapsucker.
And thanks again for calling, Sylvia. Appreciate it very much. And Kurt, up next from Cornucopia. Hi, Kurt. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I had a question for you. I've got a swan that I think might want to migrate, but it's in a wooded area that was flooded, and it's small puddle of water, a couple acres in size, with a bunch of standing trees. And I'm wondering, do they need space to take flight like a loon would? Because it's been there floating around all summer long, and it can't, you know, it's always in the same spot and out in the woods by itself.
Well, that doesn't sound hopeful at all, does it, Tom?
Well, not really, although if it's been there previous years, it must have survived.
No, this is the first time I've ever seen it there.
First
but I was
time.
Just wondering, you know, the trees are so dense. Does it need space like a loon does to get started into its flight along the water, or can they take off more like a, you know, like a regular bird?
No, they do need a fairly lengthy stretch of water because they sort of run along on the surface of the water and flap their wings before they can get airborne. So, yeah, it might be a challenge for a bird that's in a real wooded area.
I don't think it needs quite the running space or the landing strip that a loon would.
Not that a loon would.
A loon is got solid bones and sits very low in the water, so they've really got to skitter along a long ways. And we do know of loons that have gotten trapped when the ice starts to form on lakes where that takeoff area it becomes too small for them. This is a heavy bird. If it can kind of run around the edges and make a couple of laps, I've seen them do that even on mid-sized lakes just to get airborne enough to get over the trees. It takes a lot to get a big body like that up. These trumpeter swans, they may go 25 pounds or more. That's a lot to become airborne. So, they do need a little bit of space.
Swan. Yeah, it's a smaller swan. I don't think it's a trumpeter. I haven't seen it up close.
Interesting.
Well, this is really not the migration time yet for them, so it's not urgent. Keep your eye on it. Another month or so, it might become a little bit more of a pressing issue for the bird.
Yeah.
It may just move on its own. Maybe there's just a lot of food and it's just enjoying itself. See what happens if it actually becomes a struggle for the bird to be able to depart from there.
Yeah, I mean, if it's, you know, it's been there all summer, obviously there's a lot of food there.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's doing well for now.
Doing well for now, yeah. Thanks, Kurt, for calling. Appreciate it. We got a photo up on our Facebook page from Jim, who sent, here we got some more turkeys, young turkeys, the way it looks, and there's a white one in there. And it's probably an albino.
Much more white than the previous one that just showed a sort of gray body with a little white in the flight feathers. That looks almost like the domestic turkey.
That's what I was wondering.
Those usually are penned up pretty well, that they're not escaping and getting out in the wild. As we said earlier, this partial albinism or even total albinism can show up in almost any species. So not unusual. And, it's kind of the roll of the dice. You know, I don't mean to be anywhere exact, but maybe it's a sort of one in a million chance genetically. Well, as we've got such a large population of turkeys, there's just increased odds that we're going to have an individual like that. Mm-hmm. And turkeys are just, they're just about everywhere
they're
these
everywhere.
Days. It's amazing.
An amazing recovery. Judy and Racine, it's your turn. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for the program. I've been watching birds for quite a while, and I was coming home the other day driving, and in front of me was a male finch feeding two babies. Well, I didn't want to hit them, so I went around them and parked the car and got out to see what was going on, why they would do this in the middle of the road. Well, the male had flown away, and just the two babies were there. And the one was trying to fly and couldn't because the other one was fastened onto it, which was very strange.
Oh.
So anyway, I picked them up, and I have a neighbor who, I mean, this has really nothing to do with it, but she happens to be a nurse, and I needed another hand because I was holding the two babies. She ran in and got a scissors and didn't have to snip anything. She just was kind of pushed the feathers aside, and the one came free, and he flew off. And I think that one, the one that flew off, had it seemed like a growth. First I thought it was maybe feces, but anyway, it flew off and was fine, but the other one was not doing well. This was the one that was being dragged by the other one as it tried to fly. And is it possible for two birds to be come out of one egg?
No.
Or how would they get hooked together like that? It was weird.
Yeah.
One possibility that I can think of is that we have a plant in Wisconsin called burdock, and it has almost a Velcro-like seed head on it. And sometimes birds become stuck to a burdock head and can't get away. And I don't know if maybe one of the birds got a burdock on it, and then it touched the other bird and fastened it,
yeah,
itself
it didn't
to
look
it.
Look like that, but
yeah, from your description, does not sound like the Siamese twin. That there was, you know, actually some sharing of body parts. It sounds more like the feathers were adhering to each other.
Yeah, their claws seem to be entwined.
Yeah, it almost sounds that there is some sort of debris. Whether this was, you know, feces from a nesting area, whether it was, as Tom said, some burdock or something, just to have them adhere, doesn't sound like some sort of a birth defect or anything of the sort.
It was just strange because, you know, the one was trying desperately to fly and couldn't, but the other one didn't make it, but the one seemed to be fine. He flew off.
It sounds to me as if they were probably kind of stuck to each other for a while, that they were not feeding really well.
Right.
Yeah.
It was interesting that another bird was feeding, attempting to feed them.
Yeah.
Yeah, the male was feeding them in the middle of the road.
And very typical of nestlings, it's the biggest, most aggressive one that's going to get the food.
Right.
So if this
he was the one in front.
Yeah, he's kind of beating up on his little brother there, and he got the food, and the other one did
not. The other one did not.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling. Very interesting story. There's lots of interesting stories today as we talk birds and bird migration with Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz. Call in 1-800-642-1234. And we're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. Then we'll be right back. Thank you so much for joining us today on this Labor Day for another look at birds and bird migrations with our two guests, Bill Volkert, who's been studying birds for more than 40 years, 27 years as a naturalist at Horicon Marsh. And Bill, always great. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having us.
And Tom Schultz with us as well. Tom, well-known wildlife artist, former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and always great to see you, Tom. Thanks for coming by.
Real pleasure to be here, Larry.
We have lots of callers. Still, I think one open line. We have four incoming lines, and three of them are filled. Here's one more at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Stefan...
Yes.
Yeah, in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I've over the years I've been so amazed by the birds flying from Canada through Wisconsin to the deep south, and I know lots of people, human beings, get lost in navigation through downtown, but these birds seem to know exactly how they navigate. And they, of course, haven't bought any GPSs, but what do they have? So how do they do it?
Yeah.
How come these birds are so much smarter than the average human being?
All right. So who wants to take that? I bet you both could talk about it. Bill, let's start with you.
Well, bird migration and the ability to navigate has been a real field of study and not just a fascination, but almost a mystery for a long time. And there still are some things we do not completely understand. What we have figured out for birds is that, first of all, as Tom mentioned earlier in the program, the vast majority of them migrate at night. So we know that they actually use the stars. They seem to follow major landforms. So in Wisconsin, the Mississippi River, the Lake Michigan front, those are some long north-south corridors for the birds. Others, they may be sensitive to electromagnetic fields. There were studies done many years ago with pigeons that seemed to indicate that. We do know there's a lot of different stimuli in the environment that they can cue in on. And so we can take a bird, put it in a laboratory, and we can, for example, put it in a planetarium, show them the stars, and we'll see that they'll actually orient with that sky map. We can try things with electromagnetic fields, as I say, the pigeon studies. So we see there's a sensitivity there. We just observe them on these landforms. The one thing we really can't do, though, is get into the bird's head to figure out how they process it. And what's the override mechanism? You're flying along, you've got a nice star map, and all of a sudden the clouds roll in. Now what do they do? What are they relying on? Certainly they move with cold fronts. So this is in fall and warm fronts in the spring. So in other words, a north wind will carry them south. So that's the general direction. But how do they know exactly where they're going? And perhaps for some birds, there are different mechanisms that function than they do with, say, other birds in the whole group. We do know this much for whooping cranes. as Tom said, we teach them by airplane to go south. We show them Florida, and they'll know to come north. And what's really curious is we've had birds that have shown up in Minnesota, South Dakota, even Vermont, and Ohio. They're off course. But what's interesting is they're at the exact same latitude as Nisida. So they somehow instinctively know how far north to go, but have to learn what's left, right, and the actual location. But there again, the processing and that sort of thinking of what goes on in the brain and how do they put it together, I think that's one thing that makes it interesting is even after more than 100 years of studying migration, we know so much more than we ever have, but yet it still remains a mystery. And I think it's one of the great phenomenons in nature, and I think that's one of the things that makes bird watching is just such a joy as they come and go with the seasons, and how do they really do it? We're getting better to understanding it, but we still don't have all the answers.
Ways to go yet. Yeah. And, Stephen, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it.
We're on the same page. We don't quite know, but we do know they're much smarter than we.
Yes.
That's about it. Thank you.
I'll share with you some of the very early theories of bird migration. There was one in the late 1700s. Somebody said that they all flew to the moon, and it took them 60 days to get there. How he calculated that, I'm not quite sure. There was a lot of different stories. Oh, way back in Aristotle, he said they would actually transform, that the birds would, like swallows, we'd see them above the water and they'd just disappear, and that they would go into the mud and hibernate, or barnacle geese would change into barnacles from a goose to a tiny barnacle, and then all of a sudden they're back again. So there were some really crazy ideas, but people had long observed this coming and going of birds with no real explanation. It really wasn't until we started exploring the more distant continents from North America and Europe that people are seeing not just exotic wildlife, but all of a sudden there are the native birds in these distant lands. We knew where they're going. We still don't know quite how they do that.
John in Greendale, thank you for calling. Hi, John.
Hi. Excellent show. Yesterday about 7:30 at night, we were looking up, and a lot of times we see bats flying around, and we saw two hummingbirds. It looked like they were chasing the bats, and this went around, you know, the bats would go one way, and the hummingbirds would follow them, and the bats would turn. I don't know if they were going after the same insects that the bats were going for, or if the hummingbirds are just showing off how good they were. I thought I'd ask.
All right. What do you think, Tom?
Boy, that's a fascinating observation. I guess I haven't observed that personally, but I think sometimes some of these young birds or animals just get in a mode where they're practicing. You know, they're practicing their skills. They're actually almost playing, you know, to develop those skills. And maybe they were just having a great time chasing the bats around just to test their abilities.
You know, why not? Yeah. I remember.
If you could, you might try it too.
A friend who was in the woods up on a hillside looking down, and there was a young fawn, and there were a couple turkeys down in the valley below. And he'd every once in a while, the fawn would kind of run over and kind of chase to the turkeys and then turn around and run away. And then the turkeys would do the same to back. And they were playing. It looked like they were playing. And having a pretty good time.
Well, and play, as we see in a lot of animals, is a way to build up strength, work on coordination, and you know, you've got a little time to kill. But it is an essential function then in preparation for migration and moving into that adulthood.
Yeah, absolutely.
More demands on the bird.
John, thanks again. We had a great photo of a blue jay from Allen. That's a really pretty one. Looked over his back, fanned his tail, and flew off. He was checking out the peanuts and suet at the feeder. And the tail is it's a really pretty tail, isn't it?
Yes, he's also molting the outer tail feathers. You see the short
That's
one on the left and the right. They're just emerging because the white is the band on the end. So he's replacing the feathers now one at a time and getting the new plumage, new flight feathers.
Really pretty. And then we had from Owen, could you ID this woodpecker? Acts like a downy or hairy, but has this brown color. Got a nice shot of it on a tree in the forest, pretty close up. And what do we got?
This is actually quite coincidental, going along with the earlier comment or question about the woodpecker and whether it was a sapsucker or some other woodpecker. But this appears to be a young yellow-bellied sapsucker.
And, sure.
They're pretty nondescript at that age. They don't have any colorful head markings, red and so forth. So they look pretty unglamorous.
There you go. Well, that's thanks again for sending that in. If you have a photo, please do send it in on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to see it. And there's got quite a nice collection of them today. Joe in Madison has a question for you guys. Joe, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. First, I've been watching birds for about 40 years. I had a teacher when I was in second grade that introduced us to it, and we'd go out to Picnic Point every Saturday. But my question is actually a friend of mine. We built some Martin houses, or a Martin house. He lives in Westfield, about an hour north of Madison. Probably 4 years we're trying to attract these birds, and they come for a day or so, and then they go a mile away and stop at the neighbor's house. Any insight on the Martins, how they decide where to stop?
We had a similar situation at Horicon. We had a very successful colony, and then when we moved into a new building, we put up a Martin house. And it wasn't, not even a quarter mile away, and it took 6 years before we finally got the first breeding pair. So it's really hard to attract them, and unfortunately very easy to lose these birds. And so now they're entirely dependent on humans to provide that housing. I have heard of people actually trying with decoys and playing recordings. So
yeah, we've done the recording.
You have tried that.
Yeah. It's so funny, you know. It's like, what are we doing?
But... It's actually worked with a lot of birds that they've done that with the decoying. But, that's one method. I would suggest taking a look also at the website for the Purple Martin Conservation Association. There's a lot of good hints there.
Sure.
And from my experience, just keep it up. If you've got them nearby in the neighborhood, just keep waiting. At some point, you may get an individual that's going to settle in. Once you get a start, it's going to be easy to start to build the population.
Sure.
But you got to get that first one to make the move.
The neighbors have about 20 pairs, so
Hang in there. Just make sure you've got enough of an opening so that you don't have trees too close by, that it's not too closed in.
I think done everything right. Just keep going, huh?
Yes.
Make sure
it's a telescopic pole. In other words, that you can lower the house just so you can keep your house sparrows and starlings at bay, because that'll be competition that they won't tolerate.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks
Good
a
luck.
Lot for calling.
Yeah,
appreciate
call us
it.
Back when you get the first nesting pair.
Yeah, I'd love to hear. And... we have a question. Julie sent us a photo, and she says, I know this is not a great photo. The bird showed up on our deck briefly about a week ago. This is from Rock Falls, Wisconsin. What was notable was the white strip up its breast running over each shoulder. And I wish it was a more distinct photo. You guys have a guess?
Can you enlarge that one at all, Larry?
I tried to enlarge it, and actually all
my first guess is olive-sided flycatcher.
Yeah, it has that sort of vest-like appearance to it.
So that may be a better shot of it.
And it's also got that very upright stance, so it looks somewhat flycatcher-like. I would guess at olive-sided flycatcher.
Olive-sided flycatcher.
Yeah, olive-sided.
And they would be insect eaters. They wouldn't be eating bird seed or something like that.
Yeah, you may use it as a perch and then fly out to catch flying insects. It may have just been a convenient perch and saw other birds coming. But the field mark, it just looks like that coloration.
Go to a field guide and take a look.
Yeah, and an upright stance.
That's good. Probably a good...
it's a guess.
Educated guess, though, that's for sure.
If we had a little bit clearer photo, a little more close up, we could be a little more distinctive about it. But that is probably the most likely, I'd say.
And Kathleen in Stevens Point has a question. What birds have a white band? Are there a lot of birds with a white band? She needs help identifying a bird.
Well, she doesn't specify where it is.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's on the tip of the tail. And if that's the case, I would... say it's probably an eastern kingbird. It's really the only one we have in Wisconsin that has a nice solid white tip on the black tail.
Oh, that's a. I was thinking band across the breast and trying to. Oh,
yeah,
no.
That all depends where the band is.
Yeah, right.
Carol in Glendale. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Yes. Well, I last week went up to Minocqua from Milwaukee and. On beautiful days and saw so few birds. And as you drive the highway now, where you once used to see all birds lining along telephone wires and such, you see zero. You see very, very few birds. And I live along the Milwaukee River, Milwaukee, and we used to have a ton of birds. And I see very few. I mean, today, this morning, I've seen just hands full of birds. And it takes forever for seed to really be used at the feeders in my yard. There are just not the birds. We need to start somehow addressing this great decline in birds. It's wonderful that we are paying attention, you know, bird watching and such in areas where there are birds. But we just, they're essentially gone. It's like this is silent spring, and it's happening now. And we need to start paying attention. And, you know, this is, you know, birds are wonderful
to see. And I'm really sorry you're having that kind of circumstance. And, well, maybe have both guys comment here. Tom, do you want to comment first?
Definitely, especially for those of us who have been birding for decades already, we've observed differences in bird populations, and birds are certainly much less numerous than they had been, you know, back in those days. But sometimes there are local differences, you know, and maybe the birds she had already migrated.
Yeah.
But part of it may be, too, there's more competition with people feeding birds. So you may not get as many birds coming to your feeder if they're being attracted to somebody else's,
yeah.
And this is also that time of year, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, of the flocking of birds. So when you get into late spring and summer, as birds settle down, they're somewhat evenly distributed. Everybody's got a pair of robins. They're nicely spread out in the area. Mm-hmm. Well, now they're flocking together. Somebody's going to have very few, and somebody else may end up with a very large flock and moving to where there's more resources. So it could be a very local movement, or, as we heard earlier, the swallows, they're already packing up and leaving. So a few weeks ago, you might have been astounded by the large numbers of swallows sitting on the wires, and all of a sudden now notice that there's hardly anything out there. So this is certainly a season of change, and that may also be a part of the situation here, is just that there's changes in the population. They're shuffling around, and they're on their way out slowly.
Yeah. Still sad. Thank you very much, Carol, for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give some others a chance to join us. Dan and Stevens Point, for example, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Excellent show. Thank you. I put out grape jelly for our Baltimore Orioles, and we had enormous numbers of them chomping down on the grape jelly this year. And then I began noticing another bird, and I checked it out in my sibling guide to birds and found out that, what do you know, it's an immature yellow-bellied sapsucker. And it came pretty regularly to our grape jelly. I thought that was rather strange. Is that pretty common?
Well, sapsucker, that's their habit. They'll tap on trees to both lure some insects that they'll eat up and to lap up the sap, which is, of course, very sugary and sweet. So grape jelly may just be a somewhat similar food source. It's not a typical bird there, but I think that's the interesting thing of watching in your backyard. Every once in a while, there's just one odd one that's doing something that the rest of the flock doesn't. My question is, when did this bird first start showing up?
Oh, I guess about a month ago.
Aha. Well, that sounds like a local nesting bird.
Mm-hmm.
That's too early for any migration and movement. And I live in the northern Kettle Moraine area. And curiously, 3 years ago, I had the very first record of an actual nesting pair of sapsuckers there.
Yeah.
If you look at the distribution, they're actually in western Wisconsin and across the north. Mm-hmm. So for those of us in southeastern Wisconsin or east central, it is not typical, but maybe the population is starting to spread out a little bit more. And we'll certainly see that reflected as we get more data for the next breeding bird atlas to see if there's changes in distribution.
We have had the yellow-bellied sapsuckers here for a while, I can tell you, because they went for our linden tree and perforated it.
That's one of their favorites. They just love to riddle those, don't they?
Yeah, they sure do.
Yeah.
There we go. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Very interesting.
Yeah, Sarah in Sheboygan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was wondering, do mourning doves migrate, and do you know what the numbers are because they started shooting them?
All right. The numbers, Tom comment?
I'm not entirely sure how the population is doing.
Well, I remember when that first was listed as a game species, one thing that the State Ornithological Society insisted was that we would do monitoring so that we could tell if there was a hunting impact. And at least the data that I'm familiar with has shown that really there has not been any major decline in the mourning dove population. First of all, I think there's very small participation among hunters who actually hunt mourning doves. And perhaps for those who do, I think there's a pretty low success rate. I think that's what makes it kind of a game species, just because it is extremely hard to hit. As far as migration, yeah, they'll stick around during the wintertime, but especially the northern part of the state, there's an exodus of the mourning doves. And I think maybe for us in the southern part of Wisconsin, it may be a bit like blue jays. You see them year-round, but they may be different individuals that you have in the summer compared to the ones that are visiting your feeder in winter. So there may be a little shuffle of those bailing out from further north and taking the place of the summer breeders. But we wouldn't know that unless we actually marked individuals to see who's who. But yeah, there's migration. Like we said very early on, it has to do with food. And of course, mourning doves, food's pretty readily available. It just gets more and more stressful as you get further north.
There we go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. We had a nice email from Barb in Spring Green. One thing people can do to help Wisconsin birds is to donate to the Wisconsin Bird Protection Fund through the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. And if you go to wisconsinconservation.org, that's where, and I know Bill and Tom both participate, and Barb says this, both participate in the Great Wisconsin Birdathon, which supports the Bird Protection Fund.
They also have a number of projects that they fund, the Kirtland's Warbler Project. There's a whole list of specific projects and others that are more looking at habitat protection around the state. So, yeah, that's certainly a way to contribute and help them out, as well as managing your backyard and make it more bird-friendly. Start right at home.
Yeah, start right at home. Anything to be doing out there now with our, as we're going into fall, with in terms of our feeders and such, in our last minute here?
Well, clean the feeders up and keep them clean during the winter, because it does concentrate birds and attract them, but it is also a possible source for disease outbreaks. So make sure that the birds that you're enjoying, that you're not setting them up for a salmonella outbreak. So keep it clean around the feeder through the wintertime. And the other hint I would have is as your yard becomes more and more bare with the leaves coming down here over the next month and things becoming more sparse, take a good close look at your backyard and start to map out of what you can plant and what you can do next spring to create a little bit more bird habitat and make it more bird friendly and lure the birds right to your own backyard. If we all did a little bit of that, I think that'd be a huge benefit to the many birds out there.
Oh, well, I tell you what, some great advice from both of you. Tom, Bill, thank you so much for being with us today and another great successful holiday bird program.
Really enjoyed it. It's a great tradition for us.
Bill Volker, naturalist, retired wildlife educator at Horick and Marsh International Education Center with the DNR. Tom Schultz, wildlife artist extraordinaire and former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Also, he was on the steering committee for many years of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas Project. Great to have them along. They'll be back. We'll do it again with them. And just to look ahead, tomorrow, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine will be our guest. And she's going to talk with us about your pet's health and in part take a look at the cost of owning a pet, especially a dog. How much does it really cost? A lot of people wonder. You stay with us. Happy Labor Day.